Hi, I'm Jason Stein, publisher of Automotive News. We'll get to the latest episode of Daily Drive in a minute, but I'm hoping you'll spend a few minutes taking our Daily Drive listener survey. We can't thank you enough for listening and want to know more about you, your listening habits, and any other feedback you may have for the program. The survey will take less than 2 minutes to finish and is completely anonymous. So please, visit autonews.com/DDSurvey and take the survey today. And as always, thank you for listening to Daily Drive.
Daily Drive is brought to you by Reynolds & Reynolds. Want to know how dealerships like yours saw increased profit performance dealership-wide? Visit reyrey.com/KPI to read the Impact on Profitability Study. That's reyrey.com/KPI.
Welcome to Daily Drive. I'm Steve Smith with Automotive News. It's Friday, September 18th. The last few episodes of Daily Drive that I've hosted have shared somewhat of a common theme, which, at a macro level, has been an exploration of smart cities and the future of mobility. My guests have shared points of view on notable cities taking the lead in creating world-class mobility solutions. And last week, we started to delve into the idea of personal air mobility, a topic we'll continue exploring next week. Today, we carry on that theme in my conversation with Kent Larson, director of the City Science Research Group at the MIT Media Lab. Kent and his team have been at the forefront of the science behind what helps cities thrive for decades. And today, they are using augmented reality and other technologies to visualize the massive amounts of data his team collects, everything from the flow of traffic to the flow of money. According to Kent, that's the easy part. The really interesting stuff happens when you're able to harness that data and technologies to predict what's going to happen. What happens, for example, to traffic flows if city planners are interested in adding a new green space? Or what scenarios can be predicted when modeling traffic flows that include dedicated lanes for autonomous vehicles, micro-mobility solutions, and other means of urban transportation? Kent and his team are also building and testing vehicles to operate in the urban environments they're studying every day. The latest incarnation is the Persuasive Electric Vehicle, or PEV, a vehicle that's a little bit bicycle, a little bit autonomous, a little bit shared, and a lot of cool. He's also advising and collaborating with automotive OEMs and suppliers around the world as they, too, work to navigate how the future of mobility is changing the traditional automotive business. What's the latest on the science of cities? We've caught up with Kent Larson at his home office. Hi, Kent. Thanks for joining me today on Daily Drive. How are you?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So why don't you start with telling us a little bit about the City Science Group at the MIT Media Lab?
Yeah, we think of our work as being multidisciplinary. Sometimes we call it anti-disciplinary, which is to say we think we need to actively break down the walls between siloed disciplines. And so we have researchers from many different fields: computer science, engineering, architecture, urban design, mathematics, industrial design. And I think it's this combination of diverse skills and interests that allows us to do the kind of work that we do. And we think of our mission as falling into four main areas. One, I often call urban programming. It's different than urban design, urban planning. And here we're exploring this vision of the city as a network of resilient, entrepreneurial, high-performance, vibrant communities. So it's a network of communities, kind of a mesh network. And to do this, we have to be skilled at data analytics and the modeling and simulation of the interventions, the tools that can engage with the stakeholders in a new process. So that's one. Two, we're working on mobility. We think of it as mobility on demand, transitioning from auto-centric development to much lighter community scale modes. Three, we're exploring new ways of living and working using architectural robotics and thinking about how to encourage creative interactions. That work, of course, is a little different in the midst of a pandemic. And then lastly, we do a lot of work that we think of as spatial intelligence. So that's how to understand and respond to complex human behavior at the scale of the city, the community, the home, the workplace, etc.
I think two of those pillars that you described are very relevant and very interesting to the subscribers and listeners of Automotive News and the Daily Drive podcast. Mobility on demand being one. What's the focus of the research, and how is the team going about that effort? What are you learning? In particular, can you tell us a little bit about the PEV, which I think is a unique and wildly interesting vehicle?
Yeah, so I mean, we've been working in the field of mobility for about 10 years. We started the first major project we did in this area. We called the City Car, which was a two-seater urban vehicle that had four innovations. It had robot wheels, so each wheel had drive motor, steering, suspension, etc. So one, it was drive-by-wire, like a modern airline, no mechanical linkages between steering and controls, et cetera. It folded, so when the car was parked, the length was the width of a conventional car, so you could get three of these in a parallel parking space. And lastly, it had front egress. You could step directly out. When we finished that vehicle, and we had offers of commercialization, I decided that wasn't really the future, that we needed to work on much lighter modes for the city, community scale modes. And the future was also autonomous vehicles. So if you think about it, you don't need to fold a vehicle to occupy very little space if it's autonomous, because it's never parked in a high value area of the city. You can store it when it's not being used in other parts of the city. So we shifted to what we call the PEV, which is persuasive electric vehicle. The idea was that it would persuade you to use a much lighter, more efficient mobility mode. It also would persuade you to get physical exercise. So it's a three-wheel autonomous vehicle that comes to you like an Uber when you call it, but when the human is in the vehicle, they're under control and they drive it like a three-wheel bicycle. It's an electric assist bicycle, and then all the autonomy technology can be used for safety and active assistance. But when you get to your destination, you release it into autonomy mode. It goes on its way to pick up other people, to rebalance and to pre-position for the next rider. And we've also explored a hybrid version of people and package movement, that so that at off-peak, these excess vehicles can deliver packages as a land drone. We've built a whole series of different versions of it. The one that we have now is actually pretty sophisticated, and we had it fabricated at a shop in Nichinon in Japan. Our funding came from Japanese auto supplier Denso primarily. But now we're shifting to thinking about the other end of the spectrum. How could we make a $1,000 PEV, an ultra low cost autonomous vehicle for the city that was shared use, not privately owned? And so we're just entering this next phase of our exploration.
I have to believe a model like that, in terms of democratizing the ability for city dwellers, regardless of economic situation, right? A model like that really creates opportunity to service an entire city, entire societies in a more balanced and an equal way, removing this barrier, I think, that many find in terms of they simply can't afford to get in an Uber, or they have to choose their path of transportation simply by what their budgets will allow.
Yeah, well, I think it's we'll look back in 10 or 15 years on what is common today, which is to put a single person in a 4,000-pound vehicle that's capable of going 150 miles an hour to carry someone 1 or 2 miles across the city at the average speed in many cities, which is 12 miles an hour. I mean, it just absolutely makes no sense.
Yeah.
So we, but I think you can't separate this concept of mobility systems from public policy and urban design. And I'll give you an example of why that's important. If you could, like I said, have the city evolve into a network of these compact communities where everyone who works in that community has an opportunity to live there, and you have walkable or bicycling access to everything you need in daily life. So schools and shopping and recreation and museums and healthcare, et cetera, then that dramatically reduces the need for heavier mechanized modes, cars and mass transit, and privileges walking and biking and light modes, scooters, et cetera, but also light modes like the PEV. Now, one thing that that motivated us to develop the PEV is bike sharing is very popular, but the demographic profile of those of people who use bike sharing systems is relatively narrow, tend to be younger people, more men than women, et cetera. And if you look at the reasons why people don't use these systems, is they're concerned about things like safety, or if it's raining, they're not protected. Maybe they're going to a meeting and they don't want to get all sweaty while they're, when they're riding a bike, et cetera. So we designed a bike-like autonomous vehicle that addressed many of these concerns, with the idea that you could increase the range of people, the demographic profiles of people who would use these lightweight systems. And because they're much less expensive than a car, they don't have a driver, they use very little energy, then at scale, the cost could be very low, and just as you suggest, could be a much more equitable mobility system.
And would you agree that this becomes then an important stepping stone to, these autonomous massive or larger vehicles? I wouldn't say massive, but larger vehicles that do, mm-hmm. operate outside the city, right? Everything from a consumer trust perspective, yeah. and the safety, et cetera, but also the learnings from the technology and the, cost benefits that come when scaling these type of technologies.
Well, exactly right. And of course, if you talk to people who really understand autonomous vehicles, think about autonomous cars. If they're privately owned, they have to go everywhere in all driving conditions, right? And they operate on a highway, they're heavy, and they can be dangerous, et cetera. But if you think of it as a shared system, they think of this valley of death, right? So it's fine if you have autonomous technology that assists the human. And then it would work fine if we get all the way to full autonomy where the human's not involved and they're proven to be safe. But there's this valley of death in between where the humans, are they in control? Maybe they're not in control. It just is a very, very tricky thing to do. And technically, it's incredibly challenging. So I do believe now that full autonomy is further into the future than actually I thought a couple of years ago. But if you can develop a shared lightweight autonomous system that only operates autonomously when it is repositioning the vehicle or picking up someone, then first of all, it's lightweight. It's not going to do much damage if there's a collision. It when it's moving through the city, it operates at very low speed, so that makes it much safer. We are constraining these vehicles because they're very narrow. They're the width of a bicycle. To bike lanes, so it's not they're not interacting with heavy vehicles on the street, and also you can at least initially deploy them on fixed routes like bike lanes, right? And since it's shared use, if you have icy, stormy conditions, you just say the service is not available today. So I do think these kinds of systems could be deployed much earlier. Probably many years earlier than fully autonomous heavy vehicles that have to operate in all conditions.
The other research platform I want to talk about, and you know, the symbiotic relationship that has always been between cities and transportation, is CityScope. You all are using AI and AR and capturing and aggregating data, visualizing data, traffic flow, temperature, even you know, where money is being spent and invested in the CityScope platform. Can you share a little bit more about what that is? Personally, I think it's some of the coolest stuff that I've seen. I'd love for you to share a little bit about what's going on with the CityScope project and what answers I think you're trying to find by aggregating and bringing and visualizing this data.
Yeah. Well, first of all, that's really important to have a platform where you can visualize data, understand new patterns, gain insight into how the city functions now. But data visualization alone really gets you nothing but insight, right? It doesn't actually improve the conditions. So then you have to identify the interventions that will make lives, richer and increase the social performance and the environmental performance and all that. So that's modeling the potential impact of these interventions using simulation. You can do that on a workstation. The real challenge we found is not having the vision of the future, that's important, but that alone is not going to get you very far. You need to also have the systems that are deployed in the city, but you know, those two together don't get you very far unless you can engage with the three key stakeholders that need to come together to make decisions and adopt innovation. That's the community, investors, and government. So we're looking at different versions of our platform that, first of all, can engage with the community, help them collectively arrive at a shared vision of their future to model different scenarios, get impact, understand the impact, positive and negative, of these things that are proposed. We're looking at new types of ESG, environmental social governance metrics that the investment community is adopting, and bringing those into the platform so you can engage with the investors that invest in these systems, and also really critically in the government, you know, so to expedite the adoption and the approvals needed if it's a real estate project or an infrastructure project. So think about the Sidewalk Labs project in Toronto that was canceled a few months ago. They had great ideas, great vision, in my opinion. They had a lot of good systems they were proposing. They never found an effective way to build trust in the community, to demonstrate the value to the community, and to engage with the government to expedite all the approvals that are needed. And so the two go hand in hand. So the mobility on demand PEV, those are examples of the systems that we're developing. But in my opinion, even more critical are the platforms that allow you to engage with the stakeholders so you can facilitate the adoption and acceptance of innovation.
You'd mentioned Denso earlier as a partner, on a tier one automotive supplier, global scale. What kind of support and interest and engagement are you getting from traditional automakers, Denso, other suppliers, OEMs? How are they, helping, participating, engaging the work that you all are doing at the MIT Media Lab? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I did a workshop with I won't mention the company, but they all kind of have the same attitude nowadays. But it was a group leadership. They were the leaders of the various divisions of this big auto company. And I walked into the room and I just rolled the dice. I said, well, I don't know what you guys want to talk about, but I'd love to talk about how to get rid of cars in cities. And to my surprise and pleasure, they said, great. That's exactly the kind of thing we'd like to talk about, because our future is not being an auto company. Automobiles are just, low margin commodities. We want to be a mobility service provider, and we want to understand, you know, what the future is. And every time I talk to a company, whether it's Daimler or Toyota or even Mahindra and Tata, that's what, for the most part, they say. We're looking at evolving from a commodity to a service company. And so I think that's a lot of what motivated Denso's involvement, because this PEV that we worked with on them on, it wasn't to be sold in the private market. It's a new type of service using a new type of vehicle. We're just finishing a project with Ford, which had nothing to do with new mobility. It was all about developing the modeling and simulation of all of this innovation from land use to mobility systems for the new their new Corktown, you know, headquarters project in Detroit. So I find that the leadership in these auto companies are actually quite innovative. You know, many there are groups in all these companies that are not. They're kind of stuck in the old ways. But for the most part, at least the people that I deal with is kind of a self-selected group that ends up coming to us at the Media Lab. I'm surprised at how forward-thinking they are. So I've enjoyed our interactions with the car companies.
I think that's going to be music to our ears to many of our listeners. Time for one more question just to close. So you all are clearly working on a mission to solve some complex societal problems, you know, whether it's 3, 5, 10, 15 years from now, the horizon, I think we can all agree, is still out. But when you look at the journey to get there, what are the biggest barriers? What are the biggest challenges that concern you that might delay these solutions, this mission?
Well, I'd go back to the Sidewalk Labs experience, but you could also point to the experience that Uber, for example, had, hitting a wall when they would try to expand into certain cities. I think that industry is doing a pretty good job of developing innovative systems. I'm not worried about the innovation that comes out of places like MIT or comes out of companies' R&D groups. There's lots and lots of innovation out there. I think the real challenge is finding a new way for industry, if we're talking about cities, industry to work with governments so that it's a win-win. The companies can make a profit and deploy innovation, but the governments and the communities that they serve need to understand what's in it for them and what is not just return on investment for the companies, but what is the return to the community if these systems are deployed? And I think we haven't figured out a great way to do that. So I point back to what I was talking about with our CityScope project. I think the real barrier is a lack of trust that these companies are going to come in and deploy systems that are actually good for the community. I think the companies want to do that, but governments haven't figured out how to set the rules of the game. So everybody's playing by the same rules and establish what the priorities are. I think for me, that's the next big challenge.
Kent, thank you for joining me on Daily Drive. Fascinating conversation, fascinating work you and your team are doing. I think our listeners are going to enjoy this story very much. Thanks again.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. Have a great day.
That's Daily Drive for Friday, September 18th. For breaking news, go to autonews.com. And to catch up on all of our episodes, go to autonews.com/Daily Drive. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Monday. Have an amazing weekend. And now, some words from our sponsor.
In today's automotive market, maximizing existing profit centers and creating new ones is more than a savvy move. It's the biggest factor in getting the most out of every customer opportunity. What would it mean to improve your profit performance in every area of your dealership? More customer pay ROs. More finance gross from new and used vehicles. Fewer write-offs in service. Reduced time required to complete a deal. The key to all of that, and more, is giving your employees the freedom to drive revenue. Time they spend focused on manual processes is time that can, and should, be used in more profitable ways. When this happens, processes are redefined, employees are empowered, and attention can be turned back to the customer. It all adds up to your dealership becoming the best version of itself. The big question is, how much more do you stand to make? How would a 44.3% increase in service department gross affect you? What about a 25.7% increase in combined gross per new vehicle sold? Those aren't theoretical figures. They are real key performance indicators from a 3-year study of dealerships who gave their employees that freedom to do more with their time. With the right tools behind your revenue drivers, you'll see improved profit performance too. To see more key performance indicators from real dealerships like yours, visit reyrey.com/KPI and read the full Impact on Profitability report. That's reyrey.com/KPI.